Welcome to Paradise Found. I'm sure many listeners have read or have heard about the famous book, Paradise Lost, from the 17th century English poet John Milton. It is an epic poem in blank verse. The poem concerns the biblical story of the fall of man, the temptation of Adam and Eve by Satan, and the expulsion from the Garden of Eden. In this podcast, I present a viewpoint claiming the story of Adam and Eve is allegorical, and the paradise of Eden is a metaphor for the entire earth. So next time you are in your favorite place, close your eyes and imagine a paradise. Then open your eyes and realize that you have found it. Then consider what is causing our entire planet to not be a paradise. You will conclude the obvious, which is all the negative, evil actions of many, many, many people as the root cause. It's time to start working together, maximizing unity and expanding on the subject by discussing realistic and effective solutions. You can find more information in the directory of all my podcasts as they are released under my website for my book with the same title at www.paradisefoundbook.com. The book is divided into 12 chapters named after the months of the year with four podcast episodes per chapter.
Secondly, we're in a situation where we have put together, and you guys did it for our administration, the President Obama's administration before this. We have put together, I think, the most extensive and inclusive voter fraud organization in the history of American politics.
Welcome to Paradise Found, January, week number two. And as promised, I'd always throw in something, I don't know, I just, out of random, I'll pick something. And that was Joe Biden, what I think will go down as in history and into an interesting quote. I'm not going to comment on that, on this too much, but I just, I think I thought, second week. So I thought January 6th, all that happened with January 6th. And then you reverted back to the root cause. And, I think that quote, I mean, it's truly coming from an evil entity. And, I'm going to argue that further in my book. And I hope you'll listen further. I know there's a lot of people that, once you start, arguing about Joe Biden and the Washington establishment, they'll immediately be turned off. So I just have to say that I hope you won't. I think I'm going to, my podcast is going to expose them for what they are and what I believe that they are. And I do believe that they are truly, truly evil. And so anyway, I won't have enough time to comment on that any further. So, this podcast, I want to just introduce, the chapters, like I said, the chapters are named after the months of the year. So there's this podcast will introduce February's chapter, March's chapter, and April's chapter. So beginning with February, I wanted to pick a story, personal story, that sort of ties into the topic that I'm going to talk about. So, February, where I lived in Santa Cruz, one of the most popular things, and I went down, I think it was in the, I can't remember exactly what year, but it was in the 1990s, there's the, AT&T golf tournament. It's a big golf tournament, started by Bing Crosby, down at Pebble Beach, beautiful, beautiful, right next to the ocean, just a gorgeous, spectacular golf course. Beautiful area as well. And during that time, well, the big hit of the was Bill Murray. I mean, he's just he was just a lovable, and it seemed like I went down there and I went to go visit my brother-in-law and my my sister, and they had a young daughter, my niece, and you know, I met him down there, and then you basically walk towards, you know, you go to particular, you know, down at the putting or whatever, the green, and you know, watch all these celebrities come down. And Bill Murray for years was, I think still, it was a major draw. And just to make a real long story short, is that I remember going down, you know, and then we were up sitting by like the green, you know, at the gallery of the green. And then my brother-in-law had my niece and was a young child in a backpack. And he was walking up the fairway. And our guys, I remember seeing him because he like walked up and Bill Murray was walking down. I think he did it on purpose, but anyway, I could see him chatting, you know, for a couple, you know, a few seconds. And then we went down. But I can remember Bill Murray in coming down and, you know, visiting the crowd. And then also seeing him in the, you know, for years living in Santa Cruz County, they would always have the golf tournament on the news. And bottom line, basically, Bill Murray was just a big hit. And obviously that came from everybody watched Saturday Night Live. They love watching him on Saturday Night Live, but in particular was the movie Caddyshack. I don't think there's a golfer on the planet that hasn't watched Caddyshack, and everybody loved Caddyshack. And but the point of this story is that when I was there, you know, Bill Murray, and he would always be receptive to giving, you know, some antics or. And the crowd just always, it just really loved him. It was a large crowd of complete strangers. You know, there's so many, you know, strangers. And, you know, oftentimes I think we're with family or we're with friends, and we just sort of feel this unique bond or, you know, just a very special bond. But this was a case where it was just such a large group of people, of complete strangers, that you felt like you were, and then you were also in this beautiful area. I know that a lot of environmentalists are against golf courses because they, you know, they use a lot of fertilizers or whatever. But this in Pebble Beach and all those golf courses, it's just a really, it's a beautiful area with all the cypress trees, and you know, up against the ocean. And for that one time period, I felt that I was in a large group that shared sort of this, you know, love of, you know, having a thing. So that's, again, I wanted to tie it into the next chapter, is that I feel that love is a very special, the most powerful energy in the universe. So February's chapter is titled Metaphysics and Physics. And meta is Greek for behind. So metaphysics is basically, you know, what is behind physics. That's the definition of physics. And, you know, I think people need, physics is truly the heart of all science. In other words, everything in the physical universe, you know, chemistry, biology, medicine, all the various branches of science, if you get to the heart of it, can be explained with, you know, physics. So, I wanted to say that a single cell in the human body, or a singular, let's just, for example, use for example, like an amoeba, which is basically one cell and it's a you know, physical animal. It has 100 trillion atoms, and it's, you know, it and those 100 trillion atoms are, you know, control, they are under the law of physics, so they just basically do, you know what the laws of physics controls them to do. So the life of that amoeba in a certain space and a certain time has a life, and all the atoms and cells of the amoeba and all the atoms and cells that the amoeba is surrounded by creates this life. Well, you know, expand upon that is that human beings are made up of approximately 30 trillion cells. So multiply 100 by 30 trillion cells, and you basically make up 3 times 10 to the 27th, which is an octillion number of atoms and molecules that make up the human body. So again, your life is basically all the atoms and molecules interacting. And there's also, I think there's 100 trillion, bacteria and all the inside your body that are all basically, again, the point is that all these atoms and molecules are under the laws of physics, and that your life is, run that way. So in this chapter, I kind of include this term that we're basically a biological robot. We're basically comprised of atoms and molecules, and they're going to do what they're going to do based on the laws of physics. So in other words, we don't have to create AI because we're it. We don't have to create a robot out of inorganic atoms and molecules, and because we have a superior form of organic atoms and molecules that have this very extremely complex system that can replicate themselves and create our human bodies. Big question is why? And I can't understand the atheists. I can't understand why you would even think that there's nothing. There's nothing. There's nobody. There's no higher power behind all this. And my belief is that our spirits are behind that have the opportunity to live in our bodies, our biological robots, if you will, and just in order to develop. So we have the opportunity to live our lives and enjoy our lives, and yes, our bodies are, they exist. And the reason why is because we're given the opportunity to develop our spirit to basically move on to the next level. So this chapter is really jam-packed with a lot, and it's very important. And I always tie back in it because I believe that if people really actually believe in this, and that they would understand the value of the Earth as, to protect, to save our planet, save our special planet of Earth, And this is just another added reason, you know, a much more compelling reason to save our planet. And it, you know, it's not just the physical, not just our, okay, what's the average lifespan that we have at 75? Okay, you know, I think, you know, my dad lived to 98 or whatever, but, you know, we're going to all die at, you know, 70, 80, 90. If you know, and it's important to save the planet so everybody lives that time, but it's also important to basically, which I believe we'll all be able to go advance to the afterlife. So in addition, this chapter really goes in. I mean, this chapter is just, I really jam-packed a lot because I think it's so important, but it is complex. There is so much science that is going on today that doesn't advance humanity. It's diverted. I'm not saying, a lot of the science, and again, physics, the science in general stops at explaining. It comes to an end. It only explains the physical universe, okay? Then it stops. It doesn't go on, and it doesn't go into metaphysics whatsoever. There's nothing that's helpful. So yes, understanding all the actions of atoms and molecules and what they do and all the things that they do and all the atoms and molecules that comprise your human body, and understanding all that is very extremely complex. But you know, we have so many scientists. You know, evolution is not a science. It's an observation of nature. It's an observation, and one of the things that and people have invested so much into. Let's not talk about. We're going to remove religion from the schools, and evolution's going to answer it. Evolution doesn't answer anything. There's a science called any scientist that doesn't believe in a higher power and doesn't believe in God is a complete and utter quack. Okay. And, you know, there's Richard, I don't know what his name, Richard Dawson or Dawkins or whatever. I mean, he's an evolutionary biologist. And there's this branch of evolutionary science called abiogenesis. Okay, they've tried for 60 years to try to say how life was created on Earth. So they think that their motivation was that they're gonna show that life started, somehow on Earth, and then evolution took over and created what we see today. Okay, and so they hypothesize that under the ocean, there's these hydrothermal vents where, okay, the first life started. Okay, and then I remember looking at this and going, okay, obviously they're going to pick some mysterious place like this where they're going to develop this, this quackery science that they're going to find the origin of life. And they haven't been able to do anything. The only thing that they've been able to do is, and then they go, oh, okay, there was a lot of lightning and stuff, and then they're able to create amino acids, and they did some stuff with creating RNA molecules. But just one cell is just so complex that they don't even, can't even come close. And then there was one that's quack. I'm not going to call these people scientists because they're not scientists. That he said, oh, well, there must have been some cosmic dust. Well, hey, Special K, who created the cosmic dust? So these, you know, people look at this stuff and they believe it. I mean, they believe it. They believe, and, you know, I'm going to go more into detail. The age, you know, there's the age of enlightenment, you know, Rene Descartes, I think, therefore I am, and it started the scientific revolution. But I'm here to say that the science is only good. It's only designed to, I think it's a much better definition of science. And, you know, people don't even understand what the definition of, a lot of people don't understand what the definition of science is. But it's basically, it's the, it's working under the scientific method, okay? Experimenting, creating a hypothesis, creating a theory, and creating fact, the scientific method, okay? A better, more accurate description of science, definition of science, is that it is the ultimate, you know, it's the study of the atoms and molecules, the physical universe. It's, you know, it, that's it. It doesn't go beyond, It doesn't go, it has nothing to do with metaphysics. And Einstein has a famous quote from, "The more that I understand about physics, the more that I'm drawn to metaphysics." And I should end there because I'm going a little bit too long about this first chapter, but several things that I think is really very important is that there's a lot of people that are getting diverted with science that is not helping humanity. And the list goes on and on. It starts with the coronavirus, creating the coronavirus, genetically modified foods, the climate change and how it's been used for a political agenda. There are so many things that people are getting diverted with, you know, this science. And science is being used wrongly. It's not, there's few things. So I'll stop there and then I'll, let's talk about March. Okay, so I'll start this. Growing up, you know, in the San Francisco Bay Area, definitely one of the big things was to drive up to, you know, either Yosemite or driving up to Lake Tahoe and learning how to snow ski. So I definitely, you know, I glopped onto that. Provide a view of being up in at the top on the Nevada side of Heavenly Valley. You can look down up at the top, look over the Nevada desert, and you can have this sweeping view of looking down over Lake Tahoe. A lot of times we would go up in March because you could go up in March and you could buy a season's ticket in March. And so I can remember skiing, you know, and I preferred going up in the spring, but you could buy a season's ticket and it would be good for the remainder of that year, and then it would be good for the next year. But looking down, and then if all the people skiing, we were sharing common ground. We were sharing common ground, and everybody was just having a, you know, good time, and they were, you know, learning how to, you know, being connected to the planet and learning how to physically improve your physical body and be more connected to the planet, you're also increasing your spiritual health. And it's such a good thing. I mean, it's just such a wonderful, you know, I've always treasured, you know, that I've had those, you know, experiences of mountain biking and rock climbing and skiing in my life. And I treasure those memories. So this, you know, this chapter is titled Common Ground. I touch on, you know, the main goal of this chapter is to establish unity. So, and I touch on the topic that I think everybody has their own, you know, I think of the Van Morrison song, Wavelength. Everybody has their own wavelength. And, you know, for example, if you have a very red wavelength, you're very conservative. Or if you're blue, you're a Democrat. Or if you're purple, you're a mixture of both. But, you know, if you go to Home Depot and try to find a paint color, you find that there's an infinite number of colors. And I think everybody's got their own particular wavelength of thoughts and things like that. And there, in physics, there's a phenomenon called resonance. So that it's all about getting certain wavelengths together and positioning them so that they combine rhythmically, you know. Basically, it's just shifting the time when their ups and downs of their wavelength connect, and it causes resonance. And I think that that's something that needs to be looked. I mean, just for fun, I'm talking. A reason why I bring up the subject is that people from that can get together with different, that to have all these different opinions and whatever, that they can get together, and if they get together in a certain way, they can resonate. And I think, for example, the rock and roll group, the Beatles, that they would get together and they would work together in unison so well. And I'm also thinking of some other books that I read from, you know, The Seven Habits of Most Effective People by Stephen Covey, I think, and that people as a group can, in fact, get together and just enhance each other, basically. They can really enhance each other. And then my book is mainly based on trying to get together for effective brainstorming. In other words, going back to the seven issues about a paradise, going back together, like what works, what doesn't work, and being honest and trying to create a thing and basically resonating, trying to get that thing. And one of the things, when I said common ground, we need people more with, a lot of times people, when you say, oh, you know, he or she's got a lot of common sense. Common sense, I think when people hear that term, is they think that, oh, well, that's just from a commoner, that's, you know, deplorable, it's just not. But actually, people with common sense are basically much more intelligent, because if you have a lot of common sense, you're thinking about things, you're thinking unity, you're thinking about what everybody would agree upon, and you're also thinking very practical and realistic. You're thinking about things that work. So people that have a lot of common sense are far more, you know, are on the top of, they're the most intelligent as far as I'm concerned. So people need to realize that the people that have a lot of common sense are the people that we need to be in office. They need to be our leaders. And they're not, people that with common sense are not afraid to, you know, get rid of anything that clearly doesn't work. Okay? And you only, you don't rely on whatever you read or, you know, from other people. You basically are a good judge, so, of what works, what doesn't work, and pushing whatever that. So yeah, I don't know. This march is, this chapter is just really basically, you know, it's all about unity. What we can do to establish unity. So I had a very big wake up opening when I ran for water district director, and I discovered how hard, I mean, it's just so hard to get together as a entity. And so anyway, I want to talk more on that. I got elected as a water district director, and the chapter in August, is titled Water, and I talk about this. But anyway, I was so very qualified to be on a, you know, it's basically running a small water district, but I already had 30 years working as an estimator, construction engineer, civil engineer, working with other water districts, you know, for 30 years. So I know all the inner workings of a water district. And so I was sort of the ideal candidate. But, you know, when I'd go to board meetings, and you'd really be amazed. And I think you really need to listen to chapter 8. About my stories in that regard. But it definitely relates to finding common ground amongst people, because I definitely found sort of the misdirection. So, and a lot of it, actually with the political thing, is a lot of people want to be the, you know, just basically they run to get elected to be in power because they, you know, that's their goal. But actually, they're really not, they don't really understand. Some of them do, some of them don't. But I felt that I did. But I did feel that there was a lot of people in politics that they're only really concerned about themselves. They're really not concerned about doing a good job at all. They're really they do support the people, but a lot of it I've found is sort of a big show, and I think it's counterproductive to finding common ground. So anyway, so I talk about that. Okay, so moving on, I want to introduce April's chapter and the story that I wanted to, personal story that I wanted to introduce this chapter with was my birthday. I was born on April 17th, 1959, and so And then I recently met and married my wife, Elizabeth, and she goes by Beth. And anyway, so our marriage, we planned it a year in advance on April 30th, but April 17th, which happened to be also Easter, the Saturday before, we decided we'd go to, you know, a nice restaurant, which was in Folsom, California. And then we went down and had a very nice dinner. And I had planned, because I brought my boombox that after dinner, we could go down and practice our, you know, we were going to do some wedding dances at our wedding, which was going to happen at, you know, April 30th. And the wedding was held in the Marshall Gold Discovery Center, and in Coloma, California. And there's a Catholic, or was a Catholic church there, which we had the wedding at, and then we had the reception at a resort along the American River in that area. So anyway, but we went out to dinner, and we had a wonderful birthday dinner. And then we went out, and then I went, and then there's a big open area. It's right next to a big area where there's an old railroad track turnstile that where the they actually have ice skating. They turned it into an ice skating rink during the Christmas holiday, and we went down and we practiced our songs. And it cleared up, and there was this very you know, obviously Easter right after. There's a brilliant full moon shining down, and we practice our wedding dance, and then, you know, so I, both my wife and I live far apart. She lives up near Folsom in Cameron Park, California, and I, you know, for the previous 3 years, I've been driving up there and visiting her every other weekend, but I would go home the other weekends to my home in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And so I know after that weekend, which was wonderful, and we had my birthday party, and then we went out, and then we danced underneath a full moon, and then I went home, and then my daughter who lives with her mom, my first wife, we're divorced, and she lives pretty full time with her mom now because of my job. I still work in San Francisco, so I was unable to, and she just turned 18 actually, and so she called me, and then we have a family dog that has a birthday April 18th. So I'm April 17th, and the dog that I got, Trova, has a birthday on April 18th. So I got home, and then, and my daughter's name, my daughter called me and said, "Oh, sorry, you know, I didn't call you on your birthday. But I wanted to, you know, wish you a happy birthday." And she wanted wish me happy birthday, but then she also said that, did you know that the moon was on, you know, Saturday night was in the sign of Libra? And then I was taken aback, and the only thing that I could say, you know, which I was, the only thing that I could say was, that's the sign of your grandmother, my mom. And my mom was really into astrology, and it really, it sort of, was truly amazing to me, because I really felt her presence then. I mean, it just sort of, and I don't know why, you know, my daughter was, I know she's getting into astrology, and my mom was, you know, my mom, when I grew up, my mom was into astrology, and she was a Libra, and we had, she had the Linda Goodman books, I don't know if you ever, around the house, and I definitely felt something divine with her. So this story, you know, I promised that it would loosely go into the subject matter of the book. I think this is the only one that doesn't, because the title of this chapter is Paradise Found, and it's, you know, it's my book, and, you know, I feel it's my life's purpose. So this chapter, I really want to go more, delve into the history and meanings of a paradise. I want to go more and discuss the meaning of John Milton's book Paradise Lost, and obviously my book is not an epic, you know, poem or anything. It's a nonfiction book, but I want to go how, I'm really redefining a paradise, but touching on some of the more topics that are in the book Paradise Lost. And then there's also a book of the history of paradise. I believe the author's name is Jacques Delamieux, and which I use reference in the book, and I wouldn't want to discuss and that, and I definitely want to go discuss the more specifics. Try to discuss guidelines of where I believe, exactly what we, want, exactly what it would take, basically, to say, the earth is a paradise, and this is what, we'll preserve and protect, and not, and be in line with, in other words, a very unifying discussion. I think there's a lot of discussion that doesn't, really try to grab everybody, try to get everybody on the same page. And that's really a major goal of this book. And I think another interesting topic of this book is this, a big elephant in the room is discussing the population that can live harmoniously on the planet. And on one, they're on the more liberal side, I'm like referring to the Georgia, whatever they're called, the Stones or whatever, and they say that 500 million people is, I don't know how they came up with that number, but it definitely needs to be discussed, because there's a finite number of resources, and there's also a finite number of space for human beings to live their lives, and to become enlightened, that this is a topic that does need to be discussed. And I'd wait until I discuss in June's chapter about the family, and I think that I have some good insights on that. And then this is a topic that does need to be discussed, and not be afraid of it. And it shouldn't be controversial at all. So I open the discussion on that. And the globalists will push for this. We don't even need to think about eugenics. Eugenics is an evil discussion, a topic. Because if you really think about it, if we just started, we live 75, years or, average or whatever lifespan, that's negligible if we live to eternity. So if we, in two or three generations, if we decided to just motivate people that do want to start families, the qualified people to have families, it would probably be like 60% of the people. And if we told those people to try to limit your families to, absolutely you have the opportunity of two children, but because we do want to, or we should, lower the maintain the population, because the number of resources that we have, and educate children that want to grow up and have families, if to take having family seriously. So anyway, more of that, but that definitely ties into this chapter as well, because that's a big topic about maintaining a paradise. Growing up watching the movie film Soylent Green, and I think, there's a limit that needs, it's just a topic that needs to be discussed. And I really hope that this podcast and my book will bring it to the discussion table, because it needs to be discussed and resolved. And then, we should never, if we are intelligent human beings, we will never resort to eugenics. I mean, that's just, to me, that's evil, completely evil. So anyway, stick around. And week number 3 in January, we'll discuss May's chapter, and that's the titled The Environmental Movement. And June is The Family. July, Love Conquers Hate. And August is a exciting chapter, and that it's all about water. So stick around. And again, as Spock would say, live long and prosper.